Obviously, that would be a lot simpler and easier, although, as others have pointed out, probably not politically palatable.
Yes, Caleb and then Marie.
Yes, I want to expand or ask Larry on this definition of customary and traditional uses. It's something that, you know, been thrown around for some time, and yet nothing has been really specifically designed to address that. And I think if you look at the regulatory regimes that have been developed by the boards of game and fisheries, that they have not really addressed that issue, and that the seasons and the bag limits and those kind of things that are addressed in those regulations do not address customary and traditional use at all. And I think it's something that the state will eventually need to address, mainly because state has been addressing land mammals, land resources. You haven't really been, since the marine mammals have been under the federal management, there's been, in essence, no regulations concerning marine mammals. But if the state was to take management, then they would have addressed that. And I think it's something that the state needs to address very closely, because it is out there, it is in the law, and yet it has not been addressed.
Marie?
I was going to say basically the same thing as Caleb was saying, that there are traditional subsistence laws, I mean, within the communities. I mean, they have their own laws, basically their own structure on how they hunt, what is acceptable, what is not. And it exists out there. And what's been happening the last several years, several decades, is with the new federal government, the state government coming in and basically imposing laws without clearly understanding or going out to see what is out there, has created a lot of confusion. Many times we've had to clarify what is meant by which law.
Tom Lawner and then Woodrow.
I think that Marie's made a very excellent point, that the laws that were used to control subsistence prior to the state subsistence law were done essentially without any specific recognition for subsistence and what would be meant by customary and traditional use or just the basic necessities of life in rural Alaska. I think one of the points that needs to be made is that the state did not adopt the state subsistence law willingly. It was a process, the end result of a great deal of pressure around the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and the coming D2 legislation. The state was essentially behind the power curve by easily 10 or 20 years in terms of its knowledge to create such a subsistence law. It did it in a hurry-up fashion with a great deal of pressure, and its implementation, and I think that Steve's experience probably was the same as my own in trying to direct some of this, is predominantly economic. If you look at the language of the state subsistence law, while it talks about customary and traditional uses, it very rapidly reduces those to economic uses only and then proceeds to limit those. Now, the law apparently, a lot of people claim authorship to the state subsistence law and to the language that's there. And what's so fascinating about it is that those persons who thought they were attempting to protect subsistence by adopting such a law, immediately on enacting it, in fact, tended to limit what was meant by subsistence and what criteria one could use to measure it. So that when we turned around a few years later and adopted these subsistence criteria, we're trying to expand it back to what Tony was talking about and what Woodrow was talking about, trying to get back into patterns of tradition and custom and so on and get off of this purely economic mode that the state had adopted in its very protective subsistence law. It was a very dangerous thing that we all did back in 1978.
Larry, did you want to say something?
Yes, I thought it might be useful to briefly summarize what the state subsistence law does, and then partly respond to Caleb's point that it doesn't seem to be being implemented very rapidly. Before 1978, in Alaska, for the benefit of those that aren't from Alaska and may not be familiar with this, regulations for hunting and fishing are adopted by the State Board of Fisheries and the State Board of Game. And before 1978, before the state subsistence law was adopted, the boards could authorize uses, subsistence, commercial, sport uses, completely in their discretion. It was up to them whether or not to authorize a commercial fishery on a particular stream or to authorize subsistence fishing or hunting in a particular area, as long as they behaved reasonably. Some would claim they did not behave reasonably, but the test of reasonableness was the only one that a court would have imposed. In 1978, the state subsistence law was passed, and it did several layers of things. The first thing it did was, as regards to subsistence, it removed the discretion that the boards had previously had. So if subsistence uses were found to exist on a particular fish stock or game population, the boards no longer had the discretion to say, well, we don't think it's a good idea to authorize hunting or fishing. They had to authorize subsistence uses on that stock or population unless it would hurt the resource. The resource had the top rung, but then the next level was subsistence, and the board, this is even before you get into the priority, the board had to authorize it. Now, a result of that was then you had to figure out what subsistence uses were. And the state subsistence law then adopted a definition of subsistence uses, which is subsistence uses are customary and traditional uses of wild renewable resources in Alaska for various specified things. That's very important because before that time, subsistence fishing and subsistence hunting were defined in terms of hunting or fishing for personal use. And that was to distinguish fishing and hunting for personal use from commercial use, for sale, for profit. Subsistence fishing was mostly a gear distinction. It was personal use by net. Sport fishing was personal use by rod and reel. So in 1978, the definition of subsistence fishing and of subsistence hunting was narrowed, so it no longer referred to personal use, but now subsistence use, which in turn was defined as customary and traditional use. So what happened was, what the boards had to authorize now was subsistence use, but subsistence use didn't mean what it did before in 1978. Before 1978, as long as you caught it and ate it, basically, it was subsistence. It was personal use. Now it meant something more, and what exactly more it meant was somewhat perhaps vague because customary and traditional uses, well, what do you look around and what are customary and traditional uses? From a board of game or board of fisheries perspective, those weren't sufficient. It's just not an intuitive thing for some people to say, oh, that's it. Many people here have a different kind of understanding of those uses and may be able to identify them, but you need legal criteria to do it. Consequently, the Board of Fish and Game jointly adopted the 8 criteria that I referred to earlier to expand on what customary and traditional uses referred to. And those 8 criteria have the effect of identifying rural uses of fish and game. Now, so the subsistence law mandated that the boards had to authorize subsistence uses if they were present, changed the definition of subsistence uses, narrowed it down to customary and traditional uses instead of personal use. And then the other thing it did was establish the priority so that if there was a circumstance where there was not enough to go around and restrictions were necessary, subsistence would be the last use cut back. Time passed, and after the law had been enacted, not much was done officially. And then some court cases in 1980 made the state realize that not much had been done. So it was in that point that the criteria were developed. The reason many changes, the practical reason that many changes may not be noticed in some parts of the state, are in some parts of the state there are plenty of fish and game, and whether or not the regulations accurately reflect the practices of the people is aside, there are enough fish and game so that there wasn't really any need to go around identifying them. Now, it may not be that those regulations accurately reflect what would be useful, but there was no need to go and separate them out. The law tends to be implemented as hotspots develop and as data is available. So the first place it was really implemented was Cook Inlet. And the board went around Cook Inlet and identified under its criteria, three communities where it found subsistence uses to exist, and then it authorized those uses. One of the consequences of that was that it determined that the Kenai Peninsula did no longer have subsistence uses, and they were, the Kenaitse Indians as well as everyone else there, was excluded. The Copper River is another place where there's a lot of conflict right now over the amount of fish there are. There's not enough fish. People were wanting them, conflicting uses. So the board at the last meeting identified subsistence uses of Copper River based on the data that the Division of Subsistence presents and other testimony, and then proceeded to authorize subsistence uses and then allocate what was left over among the other uses. And there are many areas in the state where that hasn't been done yet, so it's not too surprising that people would have the impression that things aren't happening. The personal use category that was mentioned earlier was developed as a result of the fact that since the law narrowed the definition of subsistence uses, and in Cook Inlet now, for example, we have Tionic, English Bay, and Port Graham where subsistence uses are authorized. But what about all those people that used to fish under the old definition for personal use with nets? There are a whole lot of people that used to fish for personal use. And the way the law has been implemented, they no longer can do that. So the Board of Fisheries, after thrashing about for a bit, created a new regulatory category called personal use, which is exactly like commercial or sport use as far as the board's discretion. The board can examine the resource, determine whether there's what's there, and then can make a public interest decision on whether or not to authorize personal use. So in Cook Inlet, there are several different personal use fisheries that anyone that holds an Alaskan sport fish license can participate in, and you can go and fish with nets during the specified seasons. It was designed as a mechanism to provide the opportunity for people to fish who no longer could fish because of the narrowing definition of subsistence. And Tom Lawner pointed out that as it was implemented, indeed it has been narrowed. And whether or not that was the intent, that's certainly what's been happening, because in areas of conflict, the focus is on, okay, what are subsistence uses? And that means that some uses won't be subsistence. Whether or not that was what the drafters of the law intended, I suppose is debatable, but that's certainly the way it's been going.
Thank you, Larry. Rosita.
I wonder if we might call upon Austin Hammond and have him address what subsistence laws and legislations and how they have affected the Chilkoot Lake area.
Yes, please, Mr. Hammond.
Yeah, I've been just trying to listen when you're all talking. We had some problem while we live in Haines. The place where I tried to build a smokehouse in Chilkoot, we had a problem over there because the fish were out there. We can't catch our own fish there. You know, in Chilkoot, there's lots of bulldozers there in the river. We can't set a net like what they're doing in Chilkat side. And by this way, this fish were, they put some rods and they close it out. And the fish, it stays below. The reason why I'm kicking about this fish were, the tide comes close to it, 20-foot tide. And the sport fishermen below, say about 100 feet, they could fish. But that sport fisherman, when they come up, it's sometimes 100, over 100, cars comes up. If someone, you are here, who is taking care of Chilkoot? They had a limit to catch the fish by sport fishermen. And I talked to the Fish Commission one time, and I told them, do you watch how much they catch a day? Well, we can't handle all the cars because we got no money to pay. They bring some freezer, propane freezer on a car. That if I remember right, one car, they got two freezer. But us, when we wait another buff, we can't get any because they block it out for the sport fishermen, where the fish were are. And I've been trying to fight against this fish were, and I told them to take it off and put up above, close to the lake, where it's not real rough water coming down. Still, they tell me it is cost a lot of money to put the fish were. And why did you put it there? It cost a lot of money. Why didn't you ask us before you put it there? This is what they've been doing. These sport fishermen, one of them, they've been complaining when they opened the fish were too early. They're holding it down till they get enough fish. They don't use a spoon, they snack in it. This is what I see. I see a lot of things what's happened, but us, we had a tough time. Tomorrow, I will speak about it, about Chilkoot Lake, how I want to do. Up above, where it's already spawning, I went up there, and I noticed it, there's no more fish eggs in it. It's already spawning. But it's hard for us to go up there. They're watching it up there, but they don't watch the sport fishermen. So that I was talking quite a few places where they need me to bring it out so you could listen what they need. In Huna, I called them, Angoon, Junu. They can't get no fish from the river. It's hard for them to get it. That's our Tlingit. Lots of elders there. In Huna, they can't get no fish from the river. But they, what they do, the person that catch the fish for them, it's not even enough. The fish, it's different. What you catch from the salt water, from the river. That's why they want to catch some fish from the river. That's what they told me. In Haines, when we get on a Chilkoot site using the net, we have to stay with it. You know, in cold weather, it's kind of hard when it's raining. We have to stay with our net. If we catch king salmon, we can't keep it. We have to take it out and throw back in the water. You know, that king salmon, when they get it into the net, it gets weaker. If you let it go, the water is kind of muddy. You can see it's going away, maybe died. In Tlaquan, they could get the king salmon, but us from Haines, we can't. They weren't less allowed to take it. If they see that we catch king salmon, we get into trouble. I listen to you when you're talking about our native could get anything what we want, but it's not so. It is hard for us. I try to do a lot of things of our hunting to work for our native in Haines. They close out quite a few places where we used to get hunting. Me, I'm not strong enough to go up on the mountain to get the mountain goats. And they close it up, the place where we used to get it is a place for us. So us Tlingit, we are just worse than a white man. We gotta get our license. But before that, we couldn't get anything what we want. But it don't work that way. I'm a commercial fisherman. I like to get back to the commercial fishermen, what they're doing in Chilkoot. The fish line is way down by the tank farm. And they're counting the fish. 2 years ago, when I went to the Fish Commission about the fish were, there's 100,000 fish it got to go through the fish war. Year after that, they said 65,000. Why did you happen to taking it down like this? That's where it's spawning in Chilkoot. When they know it, if it's enough, like that 100,000, the commercial fisherman comes right the mouth of the river and fish there. They've been fighting to get all the fish they can get. That I knowed all the way they've been doing this year. Now this summer, 43,000 fish go through the fish war, and they open it for the commercial fishermen from all the way down from a tank farm. They took it up where the river was coming down on a low tide. All the fishermen's there. So this is what we got to look into it. Chilkoot, it's really for sockeye. This is the reason why I told them, leave it open, this fish war, and don't move the line to that river. And leave it down where it's supposed to be. Before, up above Fair Eternal, our fish line there, we tried to work into it to leave it there. Quit fooling around with it, moving back and forth. All this trouble we have, we sit there in Haines, waiting for the fish to come. But all the way from Seattle, Bellingham, Everett, you could name it all the way up, they come right to Chilkoot. This is the reason why I try to talk about the fish war, to leave it out, or either put it way up where it's running smooth. We like to change it. I was down Washington, D.C. That's when they came up. They tried to sample that other, to count that fish. But the Fish Commission said, leave it where the fish were. It can't work there because the river is stronger, the bubbles. So that's what it's counting. But if they had it way up by the lake, it will work. So all the fishing where it's spawning in Chilkoot, there's nothing there. I went through. Tomorrow I will talk about it, all what I had it in mind to talk about Chilkoot. And I wish I could bring my Chilkoot blanket here so you could see why I'm trying to fight against all this thing here. I brought it over. We call it Chilkoot blanket with sockeye on it. I'm a sockeye tribe myself. So all these things I've been coming here to tell you about the sport fishermen. Try to do something for that. And what they catch, sometimes they don't need the fish. They just threw it in the grass. We don't waste fish ourselves, what we use. Even the eggs, we save it. Some of the heads, we dry it. We use everything, but still, they blame us. The natives, they've been eating lots of boiled fish. We don't eat that much. Look at the bristle bay. How many thousand fish they've been sending down to Seattle through the plain? We don't do that. It's hard for us to get the fish from Chilkoot. And I hope I could use a net like the way we used to do before. And this time we can do it, and I'm working for it. It's going to come up. I was talking to the Fish Commission, and they see it's how hard for us to get the fish. And they ask me, do you know, on the Raven side, how it comes out about Chilkoot? Yes, I know it. I could tell you all. Some of you people don't know, we in Tlingit we call yeshtaaho. When you dry some fish and you're gonna put it together till it comes up and then push it down, wrap it up. There is three in Chilkoot, what the raven did. They want to find out what I know about Chilkoot. I know all the way. My grandfather tell me the story. What I'm doing now, I'm working for my grandchildren. Myself, just a few years I think ahead of me, because I'm a sick man, but I'm working, but I'm glad to be here to listen to me. I'm thanking you to listen.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Hammond. Caleb Pangawi.
Yes, I want to expand a little bit on what Austin has said, and this is one of the problems with the regulatory system of the State Department of Fish and Game, and that is with the hunting licenses, you know, $15 hunting license, if you have certain income, you can get a 25-cent hunting license, okay? If you're a subsistence fisherman, you can get a subsistence fishing permit to fish and with no cost. But if you want to sports fish, you got to buy a $15 fishing license. And if you're, you know, like in Owen River, for example, we have a competition similar to what Austin referred to, where the subsistence fishermen, the sports fishermen, are competing for the same resources. The subsistence fishermen have a certain limit of fish they can catch. In this case, 100 salmon. And the sports fishermen have no limit. They can fish all they want. They can be any number of fishermen that can fish on the Nome River. And yet, if a subsistence fisherman was to pick up a fishing rod and go down to the mouth of the river and throw in a hook, and the fishing wildlife people come along and ask him, you got a sports fishing license? He says, no. He can be cited for having not a sports fishing license. I think this is one of the things that Austin refers to is, you know, and it's the same situation around the state that should be looked at, and it's a real problem.
Well, he was talking about the license. We had some lifetime license, but still it's hard for us to use it. We doing a commercial fisherman. It used to be $200, and we have all kinds of license come up, but now we're paying it, just like the white people. I'm a commercial fisherman. I've been fishing since I was 12 years old. Now I'm 73, I'm still doing it. But it's pretty hard for this license. Even we go up Chilkat side, we're getting some hooligan. We got to have a sport license. Some of them, I noticed it, they got into trouble to get the hooligan, and they have to take them to the court. Us natives supposed to get anything what we need. Like the commercial fishermen, a gillnetter, they used to said on it, anything what you catch on your net, you could sell it, but we can't now. Now, the commercial fishermen in Chilkoot, humpies, if you're catching by the river, they don't buy it. They're throwing it overboard. Now, what this is what I'm really fighting against it. What they're doing, because they said it's too old now to put it in a can. And why did they have to open right close to the mouth of the river? And I told them, just leave where it is so you weren't killed for nothing, all these humpies. And the hunting, we had a tough time because it's close in Skagway Way and Chilkoot. You know, I can walk up and get the mountain goat. We don't have no deer and hens. That's the only thing we have. Moose hunting. It's hard. You know, when I got on the ferry going up from Juneau, everybody was going there with a gun case, taking the guns, the moose hunters. And all the boats, that 200 boats, Gilneris, they have to stop fishing. They all have to go hunting. One man I noted when I was going back to Juneau, and he was asking me how many moose I got, and I told him I didn't go hunting because I'm too old and my eyesight is not right. And I asked, do you get some? Yes, he said, I got three with my partners. I don't know how many partners he's got. He says, he's got three on that ferry. But us, it's pretty hard. One thing I like to do, on Canadian Line, if we go in there, we have to pay to go through there. Why not doing it? Chilkat people, they have a tough time because all the hunters. And one thing I was thinking about, just for the natives, it's got to be open, say about week or two. So they, before they start chasing it, there's too many hunters. Any brush moves, they shoot at it. This is what is danger. They don't see what's there. So they're going to kill each other. So many people hunting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond. Woodrow Morrison.
I'd like to expand a little bit on when you were talking about flexibility, and maybe if we can tie what Mr. Meeker was saying to it. I think what you're referring to is laws that result in what we would call de jure social Darwinism, for, if you want to use the term, a system being imposed upon us by those who have developed from subsistence users to high tech. But as far as flexibility, when native people take different food sources, there's a system to it. Certain foods are taken at certain times because of quality, and it's the right time of the year. Part of the spiritual ceremonies involve that. For example, at home, we take halibut. Our summer camps or spring fish camps, halibut were taken at a certain time because of the low content, oil content of the halibut, if you want to have a physical reason for it, and it was easier to dry. We know when the seaweed is ready for harvest because the wild celery is up to about knee height. And so those things aren't really tied to a lunar calendar so much as they are to a cyclical way of life. These cycles have been established probably since the early dawn of human presence on the planet. I lived in the Lower Yukon area for a while, 5-6 years. And the way people lived out there, for example, in the spring months, about the time of breakup when they started to get water on the ice, it's dangerous to go after moose, it's dangerous to travel to hunt. And it's about that time when the birds begin to return, the migratory waterfowl. And so that becomes a source of protein. But then as the ice begins to break up and go out, whitefish begin to run, and people dip for whitefish. But that's fairly short-lived, maybe a couple of weeks. And so when the whitefish have been taken, then there's again another break, and another source of protein has to be found, which usually are the migratory birds. It's too difficult to travel. The rivers aren't really open enough to be able to travel to look for moose, and it's also the time when the calves are pretty small. And so people take birds. And then this is followed by the salmon. And then when the salmon are gone, then the moose season begins, or people begin to get moose and also maybe a few birds before they leave south. And then as soon as freeze up, people would go and put a fence into the river made of willows and cottonwood, sunk down into the river through the ice. And then large pools were cut on the upstream side of the fence, and large dip nets used to dip whitefish. And so again, they were hoping to be able to get enough whitefish to last for the rest of the winter. In the meantime, moose then became the other alternative to a strictly fish diet. And then around December, people begin to getting eels, dipping for them through the ice. And so the people's lives are governed by these natural cycles, that seasons do change. Sometimes you have an early winter here in Anchorage, sometimes you don't. Well, the animals' lives are geared to those changes rather than to dates on a calendar. And if people are going to be able to live in a time-honored way and be able to pay respect to their relatives in a proper way, then they should be able to follow those cycles. Another example on the Lower Yukon was people never kill anything. They go out and they catch a moose. They don't go out and kill a moose. They catch some birds. The animal has a spirit of its own. And many times, the old way, people would say to that animal after they had shot it, "I thank you for giving up your spirit so that my family could live." And then it would treat it with respect. And so technology really had nothing to do with it. No, it didn't have anything to do with how the animal was taken. It's the respect accorded to that food. It's more than food. It's ingestion of the spirit of that animal also, or that fish. And also, those fish and the other game are a gift that was given to us. And therefore, when any person would come into my house and I had fish, I had meat, whoever came in was also entitled to that. And so we give to each other, not to incur an obligation, but as recognition of a person's right to it. But when you go to the store, I think Ann Reardon was writing about this, it's not the same when you buy grub from the store. You don't give away a can of Spam to somebody when they come in. There's no real relationship to that can. But when somebody comes in, you got dry fish, seaweed, whatever, you invite that person to sit down and celebrate with you. In the spring months, when the salmon return home, first ones, when we see them jump, we holler, "Ayo! Ayo!" That's a celebration. Our relatives have returned again. Creator is making it possible for us to continue our life in that same cycle. But then when Fish and Game makes regulations, then we begin to become trophy hunters. We look for the biggest and try to get as much as we can to hoard, not necessarily to give away. And every time something looks like somebody might like it, we give people our seaweed. Next thing we know, the Japanese are coming in and they're harvesting seaweed with shears. The seaweed doesn't grow back after they've been sheared. Now there's going to be a commercial fishery for whitefish. Pretty soon, native people are going to be told, you can only take these certain time. You can't use fish fence anymore. You got to do it the way we tell you, and only when we tell you, and how much. At home, us Haidas, Tlingit people, Tsimshian, and other people who live on the ocean, for us, when the tide is out, our table is set. Our lives come from the ocean. That's where we live. Abalone in Heidelberg. We tried to tell the Fish and Game people, don't make commercial season out of that. Used to be all of us Haidas could go and get much as we wanted, when we wanted. After the commercial fishery, I talked to people at home, and during the past year, only one person got abalone and was able to find maybe a dozen, just little ones, too small to be spawners. Used to be you could get maybe 1,000, but we didn't take them below the low water mark. These divers go down and take them down deep. Now we got no more. The herring roe. There's a place out there, the Corley's Islands, where a man and his wife, Louis Tom and Emma Tom, went up to the place we called Craig, now we call Klaustlai, the place where we got herring eggs. They caught a male and a female herring and tied a very thin string, like hair-like string, on them and took a rock, and they towed those fish about 30 miles to Corley's, what's called Corley's Islands now, At low water, they sunk that rock and released those two herring. And for years, we didn't touch that place while the herring grew and the spawn increased until sometime in the late early 1950s. Then they opened it to commercial fishery. Now we're restricted to 10 pounds per person. We put it there. Our people did that. And then they talk about using ponds for getting herring roe. Same of our relatives in Masset and Skidigit down in Queen Charlotte's. So they set up those ponds, and we found that they took the kelp from the northern end of Doll Island and brought them in there. And they didn't talk to Heidelberg about it. They didn't ask us. That's our country. We've been there since the Ice Age. We had to leave during the flood and returned again. Our history goes back to talking about the walls of ice to the east around Nass River, talks about ice walls to the north. Our history is very specific and tells how we got back across to Prince of Wales Island and Doll Island. But our whole lives have been tied to those resources of the Eastern Pacific Ocean. And also, in the spring months, when fish eggs on kelp was ready, we take a seine boat load of them and run to the Charlottes, Haida Gwaii, to give to our relatives out there. Later, Tsimshians would come to Heidelberg with a boatload of hooligan and with satow, the grease made from hooligans. We paid a little bit for it. And then when the potatoes were ready in the fall, Masset, Skidigit people would bring a boatloads over to us. And so that cycle would go on and on. We're always trading back and forth. We had extensive trade routes. An area that Austin Hammond's talking about, when the English or the Hudson Bay Company came in and tried to set up a trading post, Tlingit people tore it down, said, "You didn't get our permission." And they gave them permission to use a very narrow trail to go through their country. A place we have always considered sacred at home, Forester Island, we call Chin Kun Gai. A grandfather with whom I have a close personal relationship. In 1913, U.S. Fish and Game person, Fish and Wildlife person, went out, tore down my uncle's house, and used the materials to build a house for himself and cleared an area for Norwegian fishermen and pushed my grandfather's family and the rest of them off onto a part of the island where the only way to get ashore was to ride the surf up on the rocks and hope you didn't tip over. Norwegians brought in with them power trawlers. And they made a rule that those power trawlers wouldn't come within 1,000 feet of the beach. But they didn't stick to it. They came in with their power boats and they cut our lines. Then when the fish buyer came, he'd stay way offshore to where the power boats could get to him and deliver their catch. And then they would leave before our boats could get out to him. And what I'm saying is, we've been involved in this for thousands of years. We never took anything from anybody. We didn't take anything from the state. We didn't take anything from the people who came in. We accepted them and we welcomed them and said, "Come stay with us, we'll feed you." Next thing we know, we're pushed into the back room and said, "Well, we're going to permit you to do this now." Now, maybe this is idealistic, what I'm talking about. History is everything to us, to Americans. Today and tomorrow is all that's important. A system based on smash and grab, as the British call busting a window and grabbing what you can and running. We're concerned with what's going to happen to not only my grandchildren, but I want them to know that 100 generations from now, when they can say, "Die hat Augen, I'm a Haida, and I walk the same ground, I eat the same way that my ancestors did because they took care of this for us, and that's what we have." And so I think if the state is going to manage this equitably, that maybe the solution might be, and you can debate it if you wish, is that the allocation of resources go to each individual tribe and let them manage it themselves. If you allocate, say, 400 caribou, just for using numbers, say, to Arctic Village, it doesn't hurt the state in their management scheme because they can plan for that number of animals to be taken. And that's what you call setting a priority for subsistence. On the Copper River, they made a priority for subsistence by going and taking the average number of fish that people caught there and saying, okay, you're going to have 20,000. Then for personal use, they said, well, we're going to give you twice as much. You're going to get over 40,000. And then the commercial fishermen get the rest of it. And so if native fishermen, they know which runs are best for them. They're the ones who should be able to fish according to the time-honored cycle of life, rather than artificial boundaries established by law. That way they won't have to just take the tail end of whatever gets up there. And I want to thank Austin, too, for talking about that, because in Heidelberg we have the same situation. We had a young man who was trolling. He caught a small halibut. And while he's trolling, this young boy sitting out in the cockpit, fishing game guy, came alongside, said, can I come aboard? And the boy said, yes. Fishing game guy came aboard. This Haida skipper was sitting down in the galley. He'd fried the halibut and was eating it. He was cited, and the halibut was taken from his table as evidence that he'd violated the law. Another one, we use a spear to get fish. It's a large hook without a barb that detaches from the end of the pole. Guy from home got an old dog salmon called Kinga. It's turning white, you know, gonna die, and a humpy to use in a crab pond. Fish and Game arrested him because he didn't have a permit for those two fish. And it goes on and on. They confiscate guns. People are hungry, they need to go and get the deer. They get arrested for that, the same for birds. I grew up as a commercial fisherman from the time I was 7 years old, but also grew up, I would say, in a traditional way of honoring those ways.
Steve, did you want to? I
just wanted to make a brief remark about some of Austin's and Woodrow's comments. Is that, for the record, it's the people of southeastern Alaska who've endured the regulatory burden the longest, because of the course of the history of Alaskan development. But the traditional harvesting methods of the Tlingit people, this is